हरे
Bonnie McDonald, age 19, and her boyfriend, Gary McElroy, 20, had both come to San Francisco from Austin, where they had been living together as students at the University of Texas. Bonnie was a slight, fair blonde with a sweet southern drawl. She was born and raised in southern Texas in a Baptist family. In high school, she had become agnostic. But later, while traveling in Europe and studying the religious art there and the architecture of the great cathedrals, she had concluded that these great artists couldn't have been completely wrong. Gary, the son of a U.S. Air Force officer, had been raised in Germany, Okinawa, and other places around the world before his family had settled in Texas. His dark hair and bushy brows gave him a scowling look. Except when he smiled. He was one of the first students of the University of Texas to wear long hair and experiment with psychedelic drugs. While taking LSD together, he and Bonnie had become obsessed with the idea of going on a spiritual search. And without notifying their parents or school, they had driven to the West Coast, quote, in search of someone who could teach us about spiritual life, end quote. They had spent a few frustrating months searching through spiritual books and amongst spiritual groups in Haight-Ashbury. They had become vegetarians. Gary had started teaching himself to play electric guitar, while Bonnie had gone to Golden Gate Park every day to perform a self-styled hatha yoga meditation. But gradually, they had become disillusioned and had felt themselves becoming degraded from drugs. When the disciple is ready, the guru will appear, they had read. And they had waited eagerly for the day when their guru would come. Although Bonnie had spent most of her time in the parks of San Francisco, one day she had been looking through a table full of magazines in a Haight-Ashbury head shop when she had found a copy of Back to Godhead, the mimeographed journal produced by Srila Prabhupada's disciples in New York. She had been particularly attracted to Hayagriva's article about Swamiji. The description of Swamiji's smile, his bright eyes, his pointy-toed shoes, and the things he said had given her a feeling that this might be the guru she had been looking for. And when she had learned that this time Swamiji had opened an ashram in Haight-Ashbury, she had immediately started searching through the neighborhood until she had found a temple on Frederick Street. Before Bonnie and Gary met Swamiji, they had both been troubled. Gary was in anxiety about the threat of being drafted into the army, and both of them were disillusioned because they had not found the truth they had come to San Francisco to find. So on meeting Srila Prabhupada in his room, they began to explain their situation. Bonnie, he was sitting in a rocking chair in his little apartment, and he looked at us like we were crazy, because we were. And said, you come to my classes. Simply come to my classes every morning and every evening, and everything will be all right. That sounded to us like an unbelievable panacea, but because we were so bewildered, we agreed to do it. I told him I had traveled all over Europe, and he said, oh, you have traveled so much. And I said to him, "Yes, I have traveled so much. I have done so many things, but none of it ever made me happy." He was pleased with that statement. He said, "Yes, that is the problem." We began going to his morning lectures. For us, it was a long distance to get there at 7 in the morning. But we did it every morning with the conviction that this was what he had said to do, and we were going to do it. Then one day he asked us, "What do you do?" When we said that formerly we had been art students at college, he told us to paint pictures of Krishna. Shortly after that, we asked to be initiated. Okay. Yeah, Krishnas Kaviraj Goswami makes the point that Paramatma is in the heart. And so when Paramatma sees that one is serious about spiritual life, then you come in contact with bona fide guru. Right? But before that, if you're not actually serious, you don't. Right? So then here they were serious, so then Krishna arranged. Joan and Roger were soon initiated, receiving the names Jamuna and Gurudas. Oh, Gurudas. Huh? And the very next day, they were married. At their wedding ceremony, Swamiji presided, wearing a bulky garland of leaves and rhododendron flowers. He sat on a cushion on the temple floor surrounded by his followers and paraphernalia for the sacrificial fire. Before him was the small mound of earth where he would later build the fire. He explained the meaning of Krishna conscious marriage and how husband and wife should assist one another and serve Krishna, keeping him in the center. Swamiji had commented that he did not like the Western women's dress, and at his request, Yamuna was dressed in a sari. Although Swamiji had called for ghee, clarified butter, as one of the sacrificial ingredients, the devotees, thinking ghee too costly, had substituted melted margarine. He had called for firewood also, and the devotees had supplied him the bits of a broken orange crate. Okay, so it doesn't just happen to him. Now, with Yamuna and Gurudas seated before him on the opposite side of the mound of earth, he picked up a small piece of the splintered orange crate, dipped it into what was supposed to be ghee, and held it in the candle flame to begin the fire. The splinter flamed, sputtered, and went out. He picked up another splinter and moistened it in the melted margarine. But when he touched it to the flame, it made the same svit-svit sound and sputtered out. After trying unsuccessfully 4 or 5 times, Swamiji looked up and said, "This marriage will have a very slow start." Yamuna began to cry. Bani and Gary were initiated just 2 weeks after they had met Swamiji. Bani's initiated name was Govindadasi, and Gary's was Gorasundar. Oh, okay. Although still dressed in blue jeans, even at the initiation, and not professing to know much of what was going on, they had confidence in Swamiji. They knew that their minds were still hazy from drugs, but they took their initiation seriously and became strict followers. Gorasundar threw out whatever marijuana he had, and he and Govindadasi began eating only food they had offered to Lord Krishna. 2 weeks after their initiation, Swamiji conducted their marriage ceremony. On the evening of the wedding, Govindadasi's father came from Texas, even though he objected to Krishna consciousness as radically un-American. Walking up to Srila Prabhupada's seat in the temple, Govindadasi's father asked, "Why do you have to change my daughter's name? Why does she have to have an Indian name?" Prabhupada looked at him and then, with a mischievous gleam, looked at Mr. Patel, an Indian guest standing nearby with his family. "You don't like Indians?" he said. Everyone who heard Swamiji laughed, except for Govindadasi's father, who replied, "Well, yeah, they're all right." "But why does Bonnie have to have a different name?" Prabhupada, "Because she has asked me to give her one," Srila Prabhupada replied. "If you love her, you will like what she likes. Your daughter is happy. Why do you object?" The discussion ended there, and Govindadasi's father remained civil. Later, he enjoyed taking prasadam with his daughter and son-in-law. Govindadasi. Gaurasundar and I set about reading the three volumes of Swamiji Srimad Bhagavatam, and at the same time, Swamiji had told me to paint a large canvas of Radha and Krishna and a cow. So every day for the whole day, I would paint, and Gaurasundar would read out loud from the Srimad Bhagavatam, one volume after another. We did this continuously for 2 months. During this time, Swamiji also asked me to do a portrait of him standing before a background painting of Lord Chaitanya dancing. Swamiji wanted it so that Lord Chaitanya's foot would be touching his head. I tried. It was a pretty horrible painting, and yet he was happy with it. Prabhupada's thoughtful followers felt that some of the candidates for initiation did not intend to fulfill the exclusive lifetime commitment a disciple owes to his guru. Swamiji, they would say, some of these people come only for their initiation. We have never seen them before, and we never see them again. Srila Prabhupada replied that that was the risk he had to take. One day in a lecture in the temple, he explained that although the reactions for a disciple's past sins are removed at initiation, the spiritual master remains responsible until the disciple is delivered from the material world. Therefore, he said, Lord Chaitanya warned that a guru should not accept many disciples. One night in the temple during the question and answer session, a big bearded fellow raised his hand and asked Prabhupada, can I become initiated? The brash public request annoyed some of Prabhupada's followers, but Prabhupada was serene. Yes, he replied, but first you must answer two questions. Who is Krishna? The boy thought for a moment and said, Krishna is God. Yes, Prabhupada replied, and who are you? Again, the boy thought for a few moments and then replied, I am the servant of God. Very good, Prabhupada said. Yes, you can be initiated tomorrow. Not bad. Srila Prabhupada knew it would be difficult for his Western disciples to stick to Krishna consciousness and attain the goal of pure devotional service. All their lives they had the worst of training, and despite their nominal Christianity and philosophical searching, most of them knew nothing of the science of God. They did not even know that illicit sex and meat eating were wrong, although when he told them, they accepted what he said, and they freely chanted Hare Krishna. So how could he refuse them? Of course, whether they would be able to persevere in Krishna consciousness despite the ever-present attractions of Maya would be seen in time. Some would fall, that was the human tendency, but some would not. At least those who sincerely followed his instructions to chant Hare Krishna and avoid sinful activities would be successful. He gave the example that a person could say that today's fresh fruit, if not properly used, would spoil in a few days. But if it is fresh now, to say that in the future it will be misused and therefore spoil is only a surmise. Yes, in the future, anyone could fall down. But Prabhupada took it as his responsibility to engage his disciples now. And he was giving them the methods which, if followed, would protect them from ever falling down. Right? You understand? In other words, he's saying is that the food is fresh now. So you don't say, don't eat the food because after a few days it will spoil. The point is, it's good now, then you engage it what is appropriate. Does that make sense? Right. So the point is they were surrendered, they were committed, they were serious. Therefore, then he would initiate them. Right? And he would teach them how they could behave in such a way that they wouldn't have problem in the future. Right? Like that, because otherwise some were saying, oh no, but they may not stay, they may go away, we've never seen them before, this, that. But Prabhupada's point is that's a risk we have to take, is that If they're serious now, then they're initiated. If they're not serious, that's another thing. Aside from Vedic standards, even by the standard of Swamiji's New York disciples, the devotees in San Francisco were not very strict. Right? You know, New York wasn't so strict, and now these are even less. Right? Some continued going to the donut shop, eating food without offering it to Krishna, and eating forbidden things like chocolate and the commercial ice cream. Some even indulged in after-kirtan cigarette breaks right outside the temple door. Some got initiated without knowing precisely what they had agreed to practice. Kirtanananda. The mood in San Francisco was a lot more relaxed. The devotees liked to go to the corner and have their coffee and donuts. But Prabhupada loved the way so many people were coming, and he loved the program at the Avalon Ballroom. But there were two sides, those who strictly followed the rules and regulations and emphasized purity, and then those who were not concerned about strictness, but who wanted to spread Krishna consciousness as widely as possible. Swami was so great that he embraced both groups. Michael Wright, 21, had recently gotten out of the Marine Corps, and Nancy Grindel, 18, was fresh out of high school. They had met in college in Los Angeles. Feeling frustrated and in need of something tangible to which to dedicate their lives, they had come to San Francisco to join the hippies. But they soon realized that they and the Haight-Ashbury hippies, whom they found dirty, aimless, unproductive, and lost in their search for identity, had little in common. But you have to remember, the West Coast hippies were actually called dirty hippies, you know? And it wasn't, and that wasn't that the hippies themselves didn't call themselves by that name. You know what I'm saying? Just like we say, smartas. So we think that's we use it in a derogatory way. And then, so we think that the Brahmins, those ritualistic Brahmins, they wouldn't be calling themselves that, but that's actually what they call themselves. Right? They're smartas. Mayavadis call themselves Mayavadis. You know, Sahajiyas call themselves Sahajiyas. Right? So dirty hippies call themselves dirty hippies. Like that. So Nancy took a job as a secretary for the telephone company, and Michael found work as a lineman for the electric company. When they heard about the Swami in Haight-Ashbury, they decided to visit the temple. So one thing is, you saw in New York, is you meet somebody and take much longer time before they got initiated, right? Here you meet him in the next page, you're initiated. So. It was an evening kirtan, and the irrepressible hippies were twirling, twisting, and wiggling. Michael and Nancy took a seat on the floor off to one side, impressed more by the presence of the Swami than by the kirtan. After the kirtan, Prabhupada lectured, but they found his accent heavy. They wanted to understand. They had an innate feeling that he was something valuable, and yet the secret seemed locked behind a thick accent and within a book written in another language. They decided to come back in the morning and try again. Right? Anybody here saw Yamuna when she was here? Yeah? Okay, yeah. Because she was here during the festival. You saw. Yeah? Hmm? You scratched your head. Okay. He didn't. He just scratched your head. So that she was one of the first initiated in San Francisco. At the morning program, they found a smaller group, a dozen devotees with beads for chanting draped around their necks, a few street people. The kirtan seemed sweeter and more mellow, and Michael and Nancy chanted and danced along with the devotees. When Prabhupada spoke at this time, they caught a few of his ideas. They stayed for breakfast and became friends with Mukunda and Janaki, Sam and Majori, now Shaman Sundar and Malati. Oh, okay. Oh, so they were all that group. Saint Majori was Malati. Okay. Yamuna and Guru Das, Govinda Dasi and Gaurasundar. They liked the devotees and promised to come again that evening. Soon they were regularly attending the morning and evening programs, and Nancy, along with the other women, was attending Prabha's weekend cooking classes. Michael was open to Prabha's ideas, but he had difficulty accepting the necessity of surrendering to a spiritual authority. His tendency was to reject authorities, but the more he thought about it, the more he saw that Prabhupada was right. He had to accept an authority. He reasoned, "Every time I stop at a red light, I am accepting an authority." And finally, he concluded that to progress in spiritual understanding, he would have to accept a spiritual authority. Yet, because he didn't want to accept it, he was in a dilemma. Finally, after hearing Prabhupada's lecture for 2 weeks, Michael decided to surrender to Prabhupada's authority and try to become Krishna conscious. Right? Means, in other words, everybody, even someone who doesn't accept authority, they are. Right? You're stopping at the stoplight, you're walking across at the walkways, you know, you're doing whatever is supposed to be done in the social circle. You drive on the particular side of the street, you drive in the street, not on the sidewalk. You know, except in India, of course. But then, you know, all these different things are there. So one's accepting authority, right? That's going on. So his point is this makes, you have to accept authority for social order. So if you want spiritual order or spiritual progress, then you have to accept spiritual authority. Right? Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yes? No? Maybe? What do you think? And what does the athletic players have to say? Nothing. Only when we're playing cricket, then you have something to say. No. Even don't have anything to say then. Soccer? Chess? So what is this, players? Or you're an actor? Like the Vaikuntha players? No. Then? You're just a guy wearing a shirt that your mom bought for you. Kind of. Oh, you wanted it and then she bought it. No. She bought it for you. Okay. Okay. So nothing specific to say. No. Michael, Nancy and I decided to get married and become Swamiji's disciples and members of a society. We told some of the devotees, "We would like to see Swamiji." They said, "Yes, just go up. He's on the third floor." We were a little surprised that there were no formalities required. And when we got to the door, his servant, Ranchor, let us in. We went in with our shoes on, so Ranchor had to ask us to take them off. I didn't know exactly what to say to Swamiji. I was depending on my future wife to make the initial opening. But then I finally said, "We came because we would like to become members of your Krishna conscious society." He said this was very nice. Then I said that actually the main reason we were there was that we wanted to be married. We knew that he performed marriage ceremonies and that it was part of the society's requirements that couples had to be duly married before they could live together. Swamiji asked if I liked the philosophy and if I had a job. My answers to both questions was yes. He explained that first of all, we would have to be initiated. Then we could be married the next month. Right? The others got initiated, and because they were initiated, they got married. They wanted to get married, and since they were married, they could get initiated. Different. At their initiation, Michael received the name Dayananda, and Nancy received the name Nandarani. Soon Prabhupada performed their marriage. When I had met them, they were preaching in Iran. All the, preaching in Iran and all that had been started by them. I think they're in New York, connected with the 26th Second Avenue Temple. Nandarani. We knew it would be a very big wedding. In Haight-Ashbury, Whenever Swamiji would perform a wedding, hundreds of people would come, and the people would be filled. My parents were coming, and Dayananda's parents were also coming. Swamiji said, it was proper that I cook. He said I should come to his apartment on the morning of the wedding, and he would help me cook something for the wedding feast. So that morning I put on my best jeans and my best sweatshirt and my boots, and I went off to Swamiji's apartment. When I got upstairs, I walked in with my boots on. Swamiji was sitting there in his rocking chair. He smiled at me and said, oh, you have come to cook. I said, yes. He sat there and looked at me, one of those long, silent stares. He said, first, take off the boots. After I took off my boots and my leather jacket, old leather jacket, Swamiji got up and then went into the kitchen. He got a very large pot that had been burned so thick on the bottom that practically there was no metal visible. He handed it to me and said, we want to boil milk in this pot. It has to be washed. Oh, okay, so this was Nandarani. I always thought it was Jamuna that this happened with. It was Nandarani. There wasn't a sink in Swamiji's kitchen, only a teeny round basin. So I went into the bathroom, put the pot in the bathtub, and rinsed it out. I assumed Swamiji didn't want the black off the bottom, because it was burned on. So I brought it back to him, and he said, oh, that is very clean. But just take off this little black on the bottom here. I said okay, and got a knife and crawled into the tub and started scrubbing the black off. I worked and worked and worked, and I scrubbed and scrubbed. I had cleanser up to my elbows. I made a mess everywhere. I had gotten about half the black off. The rest seemed to be more or less an integral part of the bottom. So I took the pot back to Swamiji and said, this is the best I can do. All of this is burned on. He said, yes, yes, you've done a wonderful job. Now just take off this black that's left. So I went back into the bathtub and scrubbed and scrubbed and scrubbed. It was almost midday when I came out of the bathtub with all the black scrubbed off the bottom of that pot. He was so happy when I brought the pot in. It was sparkling. A big smile came to his face, and he said, oh, this is perfect. I was exhausted. Then Swamiji welcomed me into his kitchen and taught me how to make rasagulas. We boiled the milk, curdled it, and then I sat down and began rolling the curd into balls in a tray. As I rolled the balls, I would put them in a little row along the tray, and every single ball had to be exactly the same size. Swamiji would take his thumb and first finger and second fingers and shoot the balls out of the row when they weren't the right size. And I would have to remake them until they were the right size. This went on until I had a full tray of balls all the same size. So she'd roll the balls, put them there in the line. What wasn't the right size, probably just, you know, kicking them. You have to pick it up. Okay. Then Swamiji showed me how to boil the balls of curd in sugar water. Malati Janaki and I were cooking in the kitchen, and Swamiji was singing. At one point, Swamiji stopped singing and asked me, do you know what your name means? I couldn't even remember what my name was. He had told me at initiation, but because none of us used our devotee names, I couldn't remember what mine was. I said, no, Swamiji, what does my name mean? He said, it means you are the mother of Krishna. And he laughed loudly and went back to stirring the rasgulas. I couldn't understand who Krishna was, who in the world his mother would be, or how I was in any way related to her. But I was satisfied that Swamiji felt that I was somebody worth being. I finished cooking that afternoon about 4 o'clock, and then I went home to get dressed for the wedding. Although I had never worn anything but old dresses and jeans, Swamiji had suggested to the other ladies that they find a way to put me into a sari for the wedding. So he bought a piece of silk to use for a sari. I went to Malati's house. She was going to try to help me put it on. I couldn't keep it on, so she had to sew it on me. Then they decorated me with flowers and took me to Swamiji and showed him. He was very happy. He said, "This is the way our women should always look. No more jeans and dresses. They should always wear saris." Actually, I looked a fright. I kept stumbling, and they had to sew the cloth on me. But Swamiji thought it was wonderful. The cloth was all one color, so Swamiji said, "Next time you should buy cloth that has a little border on the bottom. So it's two colors. I like two colors better." Yeah, so Prabhupada was, you know, the girls should look nice, they should dress nice and everything like that. So it's part of the culture, because one is servant of Krishna, one is dressing for Krishna, right? Just like the boys are wearing their dhotis and chadars and like this. You're doing that because this is how we dress for Krishna, right? It looks nice, it looks clean and order like that. So the girls, then they wear their saris, so it looks nice. So they were wearing plain, only one color. Prabhupada said, no, it's better when there's two. There's a border, so there's something a little bit more there. So that's that, because then it looks nice for Krishna. Right? Then, when we went downstairs to the wedding, is that a new clock or someone cleaned it? It's new. Yeah? Here or there?
No, I mean, she bought it now.
Oh.
To the old one.
Yeah? Prashad. And what inspired him to get a new clock?
The condition of the old one.
Oh, okay. Wasn't that he thought we were late or something? And so. Because I keep looking at it, I think it's more shiny than it used to be. Okay. When we went downstairs to the wedding, Swamiji met my relatives. He spoke to them very politely. My mother cried a lot during the ceremony. I was very satisfied that she had been blessed by meeting Swamiji. Steve Bolhurt, age 20, born and raised in New York and now living the hippie life in San Francisco, had read in the Oracle about Swami Bhaktivedanta's coming to San Francisco. The idea of meeting an Indian Swami had interested him, and responding to a notice he had posted on Haight Street. He had gone along with Carolyn Gold, the woman he was living with, to the airport to meet Swami Bhaktivedanta. He and Carolyn had both gotten a blissful lift by chanting Hare Krishna and seeing Prabhupada, and they began regularly attending the lectures and kirtans at the temple. Steve decided he wanted to become like the Swami, so he and Carolyn went together to see Prabhupada and request initiation. Speaking privately with Prabhupada in his room, they discussed obedience to the spiritual master and becoming vegetarian. When Prabhupada told them they should either stop living together or get married, they said they would like to get married. An initiation date was set. Prabhupada asked Steve to shave his long hair and beard. "Why do you want me to shave my head?" Steve protested. "Krishna had long hair. Ram had long hair. Lord Chaitanya had long hair. And Christ had long hair." Okay. All the great personalities. "Why should I shave my head?" Prabhupada smiled and replied, "Because now you are following me." There was a print on the wall of Suradas, a Vaishnava. "You should shave your head like that," Prabhupada said, pointing to Suradas. "I don't think I'm ready to do that yet," Steve said. "All right, you are still a young man. There is still time. But at least you should shave your face clean and cut your hair like a man." On the morning of the initiation, Steve shaved off his beard and cut his hair around the ears so that it was short in the front but long in the back. It's kind of weird, just like that. It says long hair. It's like a Mick Jagger look or something. "How is this?" he asked. You should cut the back also, Prabhupada replied. Steve agreed. To Steve, Prabhupada gave the name Subal, and to Carolyn, the name Krishna Devi. A few days later, he performed their wedding. Since each ceremony was another occasion for kirtan and prasadam distribution, onlookers became attracted, and as the spiritual names and married couples increased with each ceremony, Prabhupada's spiritual family grew. The harmonious atmosphere was like that of a small, loving family, and Prabhupada dealt with his disciples intimately, without the formalities of an institution or hierarchy. Disciples would approach him for various reasons, entering the little apartment to be alone with him as he sat on a mat before his makeshift desk in the morning sunlight. With men like Mukunda, Gurudas, and Shyamasundar, Swamiji was a friend. With Janaki and Govindadasi, he was sometimes ready to be chided, almost like their naughty son, or would be their grandfatherly teacher of cooking, the enforcer of the rules of kitchen cleanliness. And to all of them, he was an unfathomable pure devotee of Lord Krishna, who knew the conclusions of all the Vedic scriptures, and who knew beyond all doubts the truth of transmigration. He could answer all questions. He could lead them beyond material life, beyond Haight-Ashbury hippiedom, and into the spiritual world with Krishna. It was 7 p.m. Srila Prabhupada entered the temple dressed in a saffron dhoti, an old turtleneck jersey under a cardigan sweater, and a chadar around his shoulders. Walking to the dais in the rear of the room, he took a seat. The dais, a cushion atop a redwood plank 2 feet off the floor, was supported between two redwood columns. Redwood trees are, they're pine trees. You know pine trees? They just grow straight like this and the branches come off. They're kind of like Dave Dutters, but they have these more needly kind of leaves. And they're very big. They're basically trees from Dwapara Yuga because they're like hundreds of feet tall. You know, and some of them are almost as like as wide as this gap between the pillars. Very big trees like that. I think they're there in California, Southern California somehow or another. In front of the dais stood a cloth covered lectern with a bucket of cut flowers on either side. Covering the wall behind the dais was a typical Indian madras, with Haridas's crude painting of Lord Chaitanya in kirtan hanging against it. Srila Prabhupada picked up his kartals, wrapped the cloth straps around his forefingers, and looked out at his young followers sitting cross-legged on the burgundy rug. The men were bearded, and almost everyone wore long hair, beads, exotic clothing, and trinkets. The bulbs hanging from the ceiling diffused their light through Japanese paper lanterns, and Navajo God's Eye symbols dangled from strings. Prabhupada began the singing, the ringing 1-2-3 rhythm, and Shyamasundara began pumping the harmonium. Although the harmonium was a simple instrument, a miniature piano keyboard to be played with the right hand, and a bellows to be pumped with the left hand. No one in the Frederick Street storefront knew how to play it, so it became simply the drone. Another important kirtan instrument, the two-headed mridanga from India, was meant for intricate rhythmic accompaniments, but even Mukunda could play it only very simply, matching the 1-2-3 of Prabhupada's kartals. There were other instruments on hand, a kettle drum, the pride of the temple. Kettle drums, they're like big, they're made of brass or copper, big like this, and you play them, they make a very deep sound. Hayagriva's old cornet, it's a kind of trumpet, I think cornet's a smaller trumpet than this one. I think it's a few conch shells and a horn Hayagriva had made by shellacking a piece of kelp he had found on the beach. Kelp, it's a kind of like it's like a plant that grows in the ocean, but it's hollow. It's green but hollow. So one end is very big, like a bulb, and then it gets thin. So he seems to have taken that and put shellac on it, which is, you know, of like a varnish, so it made it hard and all that, and now he would blow it as a horn. Okay. Some guests had brought their own flutes, pipes, and bongos, but for now they let their instruments remain still and clap to Srila to Prabhupada's rhythm as he sang the evening prayers. Prabhupada's Sanskrit hymn praised the Vaishnava spiritual masters. For each great devotee in the disciplic succession, he sang a specific prayer. First, he chanted the poetic description of the transcendental qualities of Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Then Gaurakishordas Babaji, Bhaktivinod Thakur, one after another. One prayer describes Srila Bhaktisiddhanta as the deliverer of the fallen souls. And another praised Gaurakishordas Babaji as renunciation personified. Always merged in the feeling of separation and intense love for Krishna. Srila Prabhupada sang of Lord Chaitanya, the golden complexion Supreme Personality of Godhead, who distributed pure love of Krishna. And he sang of Lord Krishna, the ocean of mercy, the friend of the distressed, the source of creation. As Prabhupada became absorbed in the bhajan, his body trembled with ecstatic emotion. The group on the floor sat swaying from side to side, watching him, his eyes closed in meditation, his delicate, practiced fingers expertly playing the cymbals. They heard the heartfelt minor moods and tones of his voice, unlike anything they had heard before. Like, his Prabhupada would always use ragas, so they had never heard ragas before. It's much more subtle like that than the Western music. Then he began the familiar mantra they had come to hear. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. And immediately they joined him. The horns and drums sounded, and soon all the other instruments joined in. Gradually, a few at a time, members of the audience rose to their feet and began to dance. Prabhupada's followers stood and began stepping from side to side as he had shown them, sometimes raising their hands in the air. Others moved as they pleased. Occasionally, opening his eyes and glancing around, Prabhupada sat firmly, chanting, though his head and body were trembling. After 20 minutes, many of the young dancers were leaping, jumping, and perspiring. As Prabhupada continued to sing, leading the dancers by the beat of his kartals, his eyes were closed, yet he controlled the entire wild congregation, playing his kartals loudly. The chanting and dancing continued, and Prabhupada approved. The kirtan of these hippies was different from the chanting of Indian brahmanas, but Prabhupada didn't mind. His standard was devotion. In his Radha Krishna temple, whatever he accepted, Krishna accepted. This was his offering to Krishna through his spiritual master, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. Prabhupada was absolutely confident, even if his young devotees didn't know how to play the harmonium, keyboard, or the mridanga, even if they didn't know the congregational kirtan should be done not in constant unison, as they were doing, but responsively, and even if they didn't know how to honor the guru, still they were chanting and dancing. He encouraged them and nodded to them, yes. In other words, they couldn't figure out that he sang, then they sang, so everyone just sing together all the time. Yeah. So the point is, what the spiritual master accepts, then Krishna accepts. So, because he's accepting their engagement, because that sincerity, that devotion is there. So because of that, then everything is nice. Right? Otherwise, then, you know, if you went by technicality, then, you know, they're a bunch of wild men. But you know, Prabhu's accepting the devotion. And everything else will come. His devotion is there when it's purified, And then how much one can do, that will come. But the main thing is the devotion. That's where you start. You don't start with other things, right? Like that. That devotion is there, and you know, basic standards. Like you see, Krishna, they're cooking for Krishna. So then it has to be clean and proper, right? So that's different because Krishna eats that. Then they're doing kirtan. So the main thing is Krishna is accepting that. It's about Krishna. Then it should be done in devotion. Does that make sense? You know? So because the holy name is Krishna, but the offering is for Krishna. See the difference? Because otherwise you think, oh, you don't have to worry about standards in the kirtan. We also don't have to worry about standards in the kitchen. No, Prabhupada was very strict about that. Right? But at the same time as the kirtan, then, because that's Bhagavat, so then it's the other cooking, and that's Pancharatra. So that requires cleanliness and these things. Yes? What do you think? Yes. It's interesting to note that all throughout here they're calling Prabhupada. They're using Prabhupada instead of Swamiji. When did it switch from Swamiji to Prabhupada? Just You sure? Before Prabhupada came, I think it was Swamiji. No, it's just he's just referring as Prabhupada. He would refer to as Prabhupada. Oh, but when he's referring how they would call him, they call him Swamiji, and from there, okay. While the elements were there, of course, people whose minds and intentions were far away in some chemically induced fantasy, yet the mood was dominated by Srila Prabhupada's followers, who danced with arms upraised and watched their leader carefully. Although in many ways they were still like the hippies, they were Swamiji's disciples, and they wanted to please him and follow his instructions. They wanted to attain Krishna consciousness. For all the varied punctuation of horns and timpani is a kettle drum, the kirtan remained sweet. Hayagriva even played his cornet in tune and only during every other mantra. Oh, so you could hear Prabhupada one time and then... Srila Prabhupada knew that some aspects of the kirtan were wrong or below standard, but he accepted the offering, and not awkwardly, but lovingly. He simply wanted these American boys and girls to chant that they dressed irregularly, jumped too savagely, or had the wrong philosophy did not over-concern him. The boys and girls were chanting Hare Krishna, so at least for the present they were pure. The hippies knew that, too, and they loved it. Just as in Janaki's dream, Srila Prabhupada's pleasure was to see the whole world engaged in kirtan. Somehow or other, he would say, people should be engaged in Krishna consciousness. And this was the instruction of Lord Chaitanya's chief follower, Rupa Goswami, who had written, Tasmat kanyapyupayena mana krishne nive shayet. Somehow or other, fix the mind on Krishna. The rules and regulations can come later, right? So here he's authorized, is that first fix on Krishna, then the rules and regulations come, but it has to fix on Krishna, right? So one has to be careful that if one is doing what, you know, some will like to call soft preaching, right? Is that, okay, the soft may mean not so worried about the rules and regulations, but being about Krishna, you know, fixing the mind on Krishna, that can't be left out. That's not soft. That's called nothing. Right? Does that make sense? Right? So they're absorbed in chanting. They take prasadam like this. So they're starting with Krishna. They're absorbed in Krishna. Right? They hear the philosophy, right? Straight philosophy. They chant Hare Krishna. So they're fixed on Krishna. Then with time, the other things will come, all the rules and regulations. Right? Does that make sense? But not talking, staying away, this, that, and all. It maybe is an opening, but you can't. It can't remain there. One has to get to the point of talking about God. Om Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Jai Srila Prabhupada ki, Samaveta Bhaktivedanta ki, Jai Nitya Gaura Premanand.